What happened is that Chris had began to investigate a, believe it or not, assassination market and a hitman for hire market on the darknet. And the mafia basically says, look, like, you know, we'll take your Bitcoin. We're a neutral third party, and then we'll send out an assassin. And Chris breaks in, to his horror, sees that there are actually quite a lot of orders being placed. And then to his second horror, realizes that quite a lot of these actually look quite serious and seem to have actual payments attached to them. So he gets hold of me.
Hi, I'm Wyatt.
And I'm Grace.
And you're listening to Our Dad and your host of the Vacation Rental Revolution Podcast.
What's up, guys? Welcome back to another episode of the Vacation Rental Revolution Podcast. I'm your host, Sean Moore, and we are back with our Friday Experts Corner interviews with interesting people from all walks of life now, not just the vacation rental world. We're bringing in all kinds of different people and talking about different walks of life and hopefully applicable and things that are going to be touching your life a little bit. And I know that our guest today, we are all dealing with his expertise. Mr. Carl Miller is joining us all the way from London. So it's a little rainy there today, but I love London. We were there last year. So Carl, I appreciate you joining us.
Sean, hello. Yes, it's utterly dismal here in London, but thanks for having me and thanks everyone for joining us as well. This is a first for me as well. I've never been on a vacation rental podcast before, so we're all going to learn from each other, I think. We are.
I'm super excited about it. And we were talking, you know, Carl, I don't even know really, like I'm looking at your bio and I understand why a lot of people want to have these conversations with you. You've done a lot of different things and really all revolving around the mysteries and the secrets of the digital world, from the dark web to AI to everything in between. You've spoken on many different stages, Parliament, NATO, web summits. You've talked to Oxford University. You've talked to the mayor of London, like all kinds of different places. And it's no surprise to me as I started like peeling back the layers of the onion of what you've done. And I mean, talk about like an interesting like backstory and like career that has really, because you're not only a speaker, you're an author, you're a journalist, you don't have private investigator on your listed on your thing, but I can feel like you've got a little bit of that weaved in there with when you kind of discovered the Kill Bill or the Kill List, Kill Bill, the Kill List on the dark web, and you know, really, which was just people hiring other people to go kill people. And you're like, what in the heck is this? Right. And so before we dive into all these different things that we can talk about, take me to the backstory. Where'd you grow up? How'd you grow up? What got you interested in this world of like this new digital world? And then it has obviously kind of timing has just evolved like crazy right before our eyes. Right.
Yeah. Like nothing else really. Well, to take it all the way back. My first real area, I mean, when I really stepped into the world of work, the one big question that so many people of my generation were dealing with was post 9/11. Yeah. And my first world was counterterrorism. So I spent a little bit of time in the Foreign Office. I then spent a little bit of time in universities. And I was kind of tangling with a question which I think I probably kind of went back to and met and tangled in different ways with again and again, which was this kind of just relationship between human beings and violence and how we can make society safer and how we can confront violence in ways which is like basically consonant to our values and also effective. And I became a think tanker very young. So I was in my kind of early 20s, really, when I kind of joined the strange and sometimes I think to people outside of it, quite mysterious world of think tanks. They're very different in the UK, by the way, to the US. In the US, your think tanks are these like giant university size institutions, basically holding an entire administration and waiting. We don't really have that in the UK. Our think tanks are very poor. They're very small. They scamper around. And there's normally about 15 or 20 young people normally in their 20s and 30s who are trying to do research that really influences and shapes what government does, the policies that they have, the laws that they kind of shape. And I joined one called Demos. I'd done a degree in history at Cambridge before that. And I was working on counterterrorism. The first pamphlet I wrote there as an intern was called The Power of Unreason. And I basically said in it, it was, I wrote it with a colleague of mine called Jamie Bartlett, and we said in it together, all terrorists are also conspiracy theorists. Why? And that was the, that's what we try to unpack. Like, why is it that whether you look at like the IRA or Al Qaeda or Hezbollah, you know, they all have basically as part of their official formal doctrine at the very core, a conspiracy theoretical claim. Unfortunately, the conspiracy theorists of London thought that I said all conspiracy theorists are terrorists. And they went crazy. They started like picketing the office. They started like turning up at my events. I came in one day, like 23 years old, quite hungover to see these two conspiracy theorists that somehow managed to talk their way into the office and were waiting for me physically in there. And all of that was being coordinated online. So as me and Jamie, we spent a year basically engaging with the conspiracy theorists, like trying to understand like what they believed and why and who they were, and trying to understand them more as people, you know, not just as not just antagonists, but actually people that kind of, you know, we cared about their lives and wanted to get to know them, you know, on their own terms. Also had lots of angry debates with them as well. But basically, over that time, I became really, really convinced about the power of the internet in shaping culture and belief. It was kind of just, you know, it was just as like Twitter was emerging, Facebook was there. But a lot of this was happening on like forums, to be honest, yeah, back then. But anyway, that convinced me that I wanted to spend my career researching the internet and then social media. And about a year later, with Jamie, we co-founded something called the Center for the Analysis of Social Media, or CASM. And it basically was a little digital research group that we wanted to build and use as a way of both building better ways of researching the internet and investigating it, but then also to use all of that to actually turn the internet into a source of study. So that was the beginning, really.
And you mentioned a word earlier when you're going through that, and the that stuck out to me, the word was influence. And it seems like that's when I look at some of the things that you're doing, you really started studying how is this shaping and influencing all of these different walks of life that we are all exposed to, and ourselves individually, the groups that we're a part of, all of those different things. And it might, correct me if I'm wrong, but it seems like that is really what you were really interested in, is to figure out how's this new digital world that we're all getting exposed to and being a part of influencing the decisions that we make, the lives that we live, the people that are in, you know, like your book, you know, the book,
Death of the Gods.
The Death of the Gods, and really this different, like this shifting in power, right? Is that where it started and where the road you started running down, or did that, it evolved to that? But it seems like at the core, it was trying to understand why and how are people doing all this stuff and what's influencing them to do it.
That came a bit later. So actually the first big question we had was, how do you turn the internet and social media into something, how do you build the methods to study it properly? Which sounds like an unbelievably geeky think tank thing to do. And it basically was, but we saw social media as the greatest research opportunity maybe ever. Like suddenly social life was datafied, like, and all of us doing all the things that we would do, fall in love, fall out of love, argue, form new beliefs, shape culture and be shaped in culture by turn. All of these things were basically happening in a way that was captured in data in ways that was never previously done. And if we could, but it exploded all of the methods that we had. You can't write a survey, you know, you can't do a poll when you're dealing with like millions and millions and millions of Facebook posts or tweets. So actually the first question was, how do we turn this into a source of research and intelligence? And so the first major pamphlet actually that CASM released was called #intelligence. And it actually coined a word, the only word I've ever created, a sockment, which isn't a dictionary.
Not many people can say that. I've never had a guess. I've had people say I've coined something, or I've coined a phrase, or I think I coined a phrase. You actually coined a word. It's in the dictionary.
It is. Yeah. Yeah. And I invite people to do Google it. SOCMINT, SOCMINT. It stands for social media intelligence. That was a direct offshoot of this question about how to research social media, was also how to investigate it and how to investigate it ethically. So we said, look, there's this whole new discipline. You've got IMINT, imagery intelligence, human intelligence. Well, now there's SOCMINT, social media intelligence. And for a while, we wrote that with a former director of GCHQ, which is our version of your NSA. And so we were like really interested basically in like the like effective and ethical collection of social media data for public security, for national security. And for a while, that's what we were really trying to build out. I was actually then bringing together technologists, and we were actually beginning to build the underlying analytical machinery to research social media. We were using AI long before AI was very cool. Back then it was very, very obscure, you know, definitely not sexy. But then as we actually began to build those methods and think about what we were going to use them to try and answer, this question of influence came on, and the idea of social media as an agent of social change that really does shape us. And first through data, and then by the book, increasingly through, I suppose, a form of journalism. I think probably for the rest of my career, I've been pursuing that question, like how it's changing us, but also how's it changing the kind of the big things that surround us, you know, business and politics and warfare and crime. You know, how are all of those and the various dynamics and processes that shape them and are really important for determining what they actually look like for us, how they're all changing result of all of this.
And is that, and so then you wrote the book, The Death of the Gods, the New Global Power Grab, right? That's when you started evolving into that side of life of saying, okay, basically like there's all this data that we're collecting. There's this like social experiment, like you almost like of a, holy crap, people's lives are literally documented by the minute, like everything people are doing, they're putting on here. And so it's like, what do we do with all this information? Then you start realizing, okay, there's this evolution of how influence and power was to where it is now, and how you're seeing, like you said, major corporations fall. You're seeing political figures, you know, rise and fall with all of this kind of stuff. All of these different things. So it sounds like it evolves into that. And this is really like at a higher level with the bigger picture that affects our whole lives, right?
Yeah. So I'd seen power changing in all of these different research studies. And by this point, you have to imagine we've probably done 20, 30 different quite large projects at Demos, you know, using social media to do various things as a form of social research. And each time trying to develop the method. But then when I pivot towards the book, there's actually kind of a more selfish reason for me doing that, which is I actually wanted to learn how to write about people. Because I knew that up to this point, this was very, very data driven. It's all about like counting the number of tweets and building algorithms to divide tweets into those about the economy and those about politics. And I knew there was a human story here as well. And I actually just really wanted to learn how to write about humans and how to gather a story, especially hidden stories that you really can only understand when you develop relationships with human beings. You can't Google them together, and you can't just collect social media data about them. You actually have to go to the places in the world and meet the people that are the forefront of it. And that was what Death of the Gods was about. So I took a year off. I then really did travel around the world. I really did want this to be a like shoe leather kind of book. Mm-hmm. I didn't want it to be a kind of lazy secondary source book. So, you know, I went on to like information warfare bases, and I went on cybercrime raids with the police. And, you know, I spoke to hikikomori in South Korea who only live their lives online. You know, they don't actually leave their houses at all sometimes, and lots of other places, you know, and got to know hackers in DEF CON in Las Vegas. And all of that was pursuit of this idea of power, which actually is fairly interchangeable, I think, with influence, or at least certain kinds of power is, to really diagnose it. We were speaking earlier, you know, there is, I think, a felt sense that so many people have that we're like living at this kind of forefront of this envelope of really, really rapid change in our lives. you know, and I thought that I very much began the book with that sense that we feel like the world's tumbling around us. We feel like the furniture's shifting and things are reforming in ways which are quite mysterious and quite hidden. And I think often quite scary and overwhelming for us. And I thought that power, this question of how and who shapes our lives and how do we do that, was this kind of guiding thread that I could use to make different stories make sense to each other. So going into business and coming back with some idea about, you know, the rise of the tech giants, you know, and then speaking to someone who makes algorithms for one of the tech giants and what power meant there, you know, but then also taking that idea, say, into the world of crime and understanding how power was shifting there between certainly the dynamics of power between law enforcement and criminals.
And so this concept of power seems to be a very common thread throughout all of this, right? It's saying, okay, how is power shifting? How are people using it? But it seems to be not only is how is it shifting, but it seems to be the underlying motivator for a lot of the maybe the crimes, maybe some of the underlying motivator of hey, listen, this is why I'm doing what I'm doing. And it comes back to I want more power.
Oh yeah, people love power. Yeah, right. No doubt.
As I'm listening to you talk, I'm like, okay, it seems like there's this like common thread here, right?
It's a massively common thread, and you're right. It's both a way of understanding social change, but it is also, as you say, a driver. It's a magnet. And all the way through to Kill List, like I didn't actually really appreciate at the time the absolute like ineffable draw that power has over people, like the lust that some people have for it. And in fact, actually, the inability to live without it, you know, that and the willingness to risk everything in some cases to get it or to get it back. So for sure, like, yeah, power became this kind of dual thing. It became for me a kind of analytical prism, a way of and a writing conceit, to be honest. Like you do have to use something like that in order to make a book hang together. But then also, yeah, absolutely. Something which people I noticed all over the world, as I think they always do, to be honest, Sean, race towards. But they were finding it. And this was the premise of the book, basically. They were finding power, ways to power in new ways and gaining it in new ways and new kinds of people being empowered. And what power looked like, I think, changed. And also, to cap it all off, none of the rest of us realized any of this. So we were living in a world where like the actual true distribution and nature of power had shifted very radically, but actually that was going very, very overlooked and misunderstood by everyone else. And that in a weird way made it even more powerful.
Right, right. How much do you think we recognize it now? Do you think that as like just, you know, as we talk about and we're like, I feel like there's a trust recession in a lot of things. Like I'm an advertiser, I'm a marketer, right? So just take it from that concept. I'm not trying to, you know, win an election or do anything like that. But I like when I go into the marketing world and I go on Facebook or Instagram or anything else and the data that Google has and the data that Meta has on the demographics and the behaviors of the consumer, like and what they're willing to give me just to be an advertiser and pay to get in front of somebody. It's like if you and I are sitting here talking about vacation rentals and you've never been, you know, interested in vacation rentals, if your phone's on somewhere and yours probably isn't because you probably shut it all off, but like all of a sudden you're going to pop your phone on and it's going to show you vacation rentals, right? They're that skilled that if you even think about something, it's showing up. And I think that more and more people are aware of that. You mentioned like, hey, listen, this shift happened and many of us were unaware. Do you feel like we're becoming more aware? And does that make it better or worse for us as we try to navigate through this?
Well, just a fun sidebar. I for the BBC, as a kind of mini documentary for the BBC, I actually spent time to gather all of my data from both the tech giants, but then all the different ad tech companies. We have a little known law in the UK called which allows you to basically do something called a data subject access request, which is you can knock on the door of any company and say, hey, I want all your data about me, and they have to give it over. And I basically recreated myself in data. So we printed it all out. And it was, you know, I mean, it was genuinely like 4 or 5 foot high of like printed out tables. And the ad tech companies, you know, they definitely did have the most data about me. But especially the segmentations that they had created, a lot of it was really garbage, Sean. It was voluminous, and I'm sure like is convincing perhaps to the buyer, the ad buyer. But when you actually go through it, you know, they did stuff like estimated the age of my boiler. They put me in a category that said I was young and struggling, which, you know, might actually well have been true, that one at that time. But they said I didn't like reading. I'd just written a book, so I wasn't overwhelmed by the accuracy, the perspicacity of the data there. But in terms of to go back to your broader question, which is, do we recognize how the true shifts of power that have happened? The answer is probably we do a lot more than when I wrote Death of the Gods. I do think there's a realization. There is a realization that hackers are around. There is a realization that cybercrime is a bigger thing. I mean, when I first wrote about cybercrime, the Home Office in the UK kept telling us that crime was falling every year. They kept saying crime was falling. And then when they added a question to the survey that they always use to work out what crime's happening, which is like, have you been the victim of online crime? Lo and behold, measured crime levels went up to where they were back in the 90s before it started transitioning online. So, you know, I think we were ludicrously unaware, you know, 5 or 6 years ago. I do think there's a dawning realization. I don't think we'll ever really be aware of what the very best hackers in the world are capable of. And I think there are some areas like information warfare where we remain like very, very much in the dark, most of us, that this thing is a thing still and it's really happening. But there's what we haven't done, and I don't think we've really got much closer to than where we were, is not just being aware of this, but actually responding to it in any kind of meaningful, like organizational or legal way. So the kind of big implication, I argued in Death of the Gods, of power being overlooked in its new form was that it had gone wild, basically. That we've always tried to, like, this is my metaphor, you know, forgive me everyone, I won't use too many metaphors, but there's no real other way than this metaphor to talk about this. So if you imagine that like power is this like creature in a cage, right? Like we've always tried to actually create a cage around it, you know, and the bars of that cage are things like the law and regulation and norms and professional standards, you know, and regulatory bodies, like all of this like dense mesh that we build to basically say there's only certain ways that we can reach into each other's lives, and there's loads of illegitimate ways. And if you illegitimately use power, there'll be a consequence. In wherever you look in the world now, whether that's like warfare happening in information space, or whether it's cyber criminals sitting outside the reach of law enforcement, or whether it's online political advertising happening entirely outside of like the electoral commission system of rules. You know, you really don't have to look that hard to find whether it's the tech giants, you know, holding new forms of monopoly, which aren't recognized by monopoly legislation. It's everywhere. Yeah. These forms of power that just haven't had the redefinition and the law and the regulation to control it again. And that does mean that it's wild. It means it's being used now in ways which is both liberating, but also in many ways very oppressive.
And you don't feel like we're getting any closer to getting our reins and our around that. Like we're still as far as being able to, I don't want to say, I don't think control it's the right word, but be able to like regulate it or being able to understand what's there. It's you're saying they're 3 or 4 steps ahead all the time, and we're not that much closer today, even though we may be more aware. We're not really close. We're no closer to regulating it or reining it in.
Yeah, because there's a kind of elemental disjuncture between the pace of technology being capable of conferring all these new opportunities to routes to power, so to speak, and that's not slowing down. That's, of course, we all know, speeding up.
Yeah,
and controlling power isn't a question of technology. controlling power is a question. It's squishy and it's soft and it's very human. It's about norms and it's about making new law and it's about setting up new institutions. You know, it's about passing laws through parliament, which are written on vellum, you know, which is a form of animal skin. Or it's about kind of creating a professional standards body for people that make algorithms. Like, this stuff takes much longer to do.
Yeah.
And like, we just haven't cracked this. We haven't cracked the basic question of evolving the institutions and organizations, society, at a pace that can keep pace with technology. And whoever can do that, you know, is going to get a Nobel Prize. You know, that is, to me, probably the most important question to do with justice and equity that we have in the world now. No, I don't think we've managed to find a way of getting faster, moving faster there.
Yeah. It's interesting, like, from just like when you hear this, like, you get nervous. You're like, maybe I'm never going to go online. Maybe I just need to be, you know, I don't want to put stuff out there. Like, how do you navigate it just as a regular human being in the world now? Like, are there things what do you do? Like, how do you, knowing all the stuff that you know and looking into all that stuff that you know that can be scary at times, you're like, holy crap, I can't believe that, like, this is like right in front of us and we're having to live with this and navigate this new world. How do we do it?
Well, it's a great question. And I wish I had 5 points for you, Sean, but I think there's like, there's maybe three areas for people to just think about and beginning to develop habits and awareness around. The first is the kind of actual criminal threats. And there, to be honest, actually, the human is almost always the kind of the weak element. It's much, much easier to convince someone than it is to find a 0 day in Microsoft.
Right.
And so, you know, it's not going to be your devices, probably. You know, I say this knowing that, you know, someone's going to hack me tomorrow or something and just prove me wrong, but it's probably not going to be your devices, you know, that let you down. It'll be you. And cyber criminality, especially scams and frauds, just to start people off, they are by miles the most common forms of crime in the world. So know that, know they're out there, and everyone's got to grow a kind of a really, really, sadly, kind of deep skepticism with dealing with anonymous people online. And there's a ton of ways, from escrow services through to, you know, two-factor authentication, a whole kind of layering of different habits that you can form just to make yourself a bit safer. So there's taking responsibility for your own cybersecurity. That's a big one. That's number one. There's also taking responsibility for your own, like, emotional well-being online. And as I've mentioned, information warfare. It's a fact that militaries around the world now regards information as not just a tool of war, but a theater of war. Like, and that conceptual pivot is a fairly new one, to go away from thinking of information as something which happens within a conflict, to actually see it as something which conflict happens within is entirely new. So it's kind of joined air, sea, land, space, and then you've got information, and sometimes they now even added cognitive, you know, as another space, so to speak, you know, kind of metaphorically, that warfare occurs within. And there, if there's one thing that I can urge people to do, is to slow down. Like, so much information warfare is targeting your lizard brain. It's trying to get you to do stuff knee-jerk before you know what you're doing. Slow down online. Be proactive online. Don't, like, sit in the passive scroll. These kind of information curation mechanisms, they're so gameable. They're what people use to get you. Don't fall prey to them. Like, you know, use the internet, especially in a very, like, proactive, deliberate way. Reach out to what you want to get and bring it back to you. Take control. Be much, you know, be more kind of, like, intentional about basically, like, the information you consume. And then lastly, and this is the big one. So, you know, I pull apart some of these campaigns for a living. And if there's one thing that's more common than anything else, it's that they use to manipulate people in lots of different ways and lots of different reasons. It's outrage activation. Mm. We are so, so manipulable when we're outraged.
Mm-hmm.
And that outrage can, you know, the thing that's difficult about that is that can tap into your very, like, legitimately held, deeply held sense of morality, which is exactly why they do it. So they'll activate your outrage. They'll normally tell you things that the that you already believe are true. And this is what people always misunderstand about like disinformation or infamous operations or whatever you want to call it. Everyone thinks that what's happening there is someone's lying to you online and getting you to change your mind. That's not what they're doing. They're flattering your worldview. They're confirming your belief. They're telling you you're always right to think whatever you think. And then they send you in a particular direction. So that's number two. It's like the emotional well-being, especially in a world of shadowy forms of influence. And then thirdly is, I think, the actual addiction to the devices themselves. I think we're going to begin to have a reckoning around this. I can see the kind of bubbling grassroots worry. I spent a lot of the summer giving speeches and talks and panels and stuff across the UK and actually elsewhere. And a big, big topic that we kept returning to over that time was smartphone addiction.
Yeah.
And especially for young people, how ruinously damaging that can be. And I think, you know, there's now a big movement in the UK to... for people to basically voluntarily abstain from giving their kids a smartphone until they turn 16. Mm-hmm. Australia's thinking of banning social media for under 16-year-olds. Probably not going to see that kind of state intervention happening in the States anytime soon. Yeah. But you know, I mean, in terms of consumer preference, I think we will. And I think we will see people increasingly realizing that addiction, digital addiction is a problem, it's a thing. And beginning to develop like kind of forms of resistance to it.
Yeah, that's awesome. I you know, it's interesting as you're talking about that. The one thing that we have like written on our walls here, and you know, we always call it the cowboy way, but it's really just like you don't have to be a cowboy, but it's this extreme ownership, personal responsibility, self-reliance. Like, hey, it's up to us to make sure that we're making any sort of change that we want to see, right? All those different things. And you're saying, you know, the human error, the human element is really what a lot of this is targeting, knowing that without us making some of these decisions, right? And keeping our emotions in check, being intentional, being, you know, proactive instead of reactive, keeping things like, you know, making, don't make rash decisions. Like when somebody gets you riled up, and like you said, they're not usually telling you something wrong. They're usually confirming everything that you believe and saying, hey, you are right. And it's okay to be like that. And by the way, doesn't this make you so mad? And then the next step happens. But it seems like there's this major human element there. And at the end of the day, you know, what you're saying is, hey, we've got to take some responsibility here and kind of curb this a little bit, understand it's out there, understand there's this new world. We can't hide from it. Right. I know for me as a consumer, sometimes I'm a lazy consumer. Like I like when I say, I mentioned the word, you know, solar power generators for my barn. And all of a sudden I've got all kinds of stuff showing up on my phone and they do kind of a little bit of the research for me and I can, it's at my fingertips. I like that. I don't want to just be completely disconnected, but it's interesting too. I had a couple of podcasts ago, we have a segment called Whiskey Wednesday, and myself and Jake, we're just in our kind of our speakeasy and we're going.
That sounds fun. Why don't I get invited to Whiskey Wednesday?
We'll do that one. Carl, you have to come in the studio next time you come skiing in Utah. We'll get you on the Whiskey Wednesday.
That sounds much more fun.
it's way funner, right? Except for sometimes we record it at like 9 a.m. and I tell, I'm like, man, sometimes you're like, it's a little early for the Whiskey Wednesday. Sometimes we do what we have to do, right? But it's, but I was talking about at our house, my kids, they have to check their phones. They're 14 and they just barely got a phone to take to, you know, when they go do their stuff. But when they come home, we have a bowl right at the front of the door and you have to put your phone, like phones aren't allowed in the house or in bedrooms or anywhere. They're not allowed at our house. Like, so you only have the phone basically when you leave so that you have we can get a hold of you or you can get a hold of us. And I was talking about why we did that. And I just said, you know, jury's still out on whether that's going to work or not. You know, my kids are, you know, tell me in 40 years if all my parenting skills were good or bad, right? It's right now, I'm not telling you it's right or wrong. I'm just telling you what I do. And I was talking about that. And it went like, for me, like for our stuff, went viral. Like it was one of the most, you know, like shared and commented topics that we talked about. And I think you're exactly right. I think that with the smartphone addiction, I think we're starting again to be aware that, man, this might be a problem, especially with young kids. And it's not, we have a tendency to point fingers at the young kids, but as parents, we're the ones that are giving those phones to them. We're the ones paying for them. We're the ones allowing them to do some of those things. So it's not always their fault. And we have to look in the mirror and say, is that the road we want to run down? I think there's more and more people asking that question and saying, hey, listen, let's have some boundaries here and maybe not, and understand that it is very addicting.
100%. I mean, and it's not the kid's fault. I mean, and it's actually not even really the parent. I mean, not only the parent's fault. These devices are deliberately designed to be as addictive as possible.
Yeah.
I mean, if you read a book called Hooked by a guy called Neary Yao, you know, I was reading that book. I picked it up on the way back from South Korea. I'd just been interviewing Hikikomori. I already mentioned them. They're people that the digitally departed. They are the most digital people on earth. They only live their lives online. And digital addiction is part of that story. Mm-hmm. And I'd been in a treatment center for them as they were trying to bring them out of that world and give them like, and it was very tangible. You know, it was like playing music and riding bikes and just doing things with their hands, you know, craft. And I'd seen all these efforts, and I'd on the way home, I picked up this book, and I thought I was going to read, an expose, some kind of, scything kind of revelatory look into this world. And it was like Hooked is a cheerful how-to guide to make your new app as addictive as it can be. You know, so they break down dopamine studies and cognitive psychology and how addictions form. And I realized it's actually part of a field called persuasive technology that every member of growth for all of the tech giants have all gone to Stanford. They've all studied persuasive technology. It's a deliberate, thought out, systematic a kind of toolkit, which is partly about tech design and it's partly about psychology and it's partly about the physiology of addiction. And it is about making both the software on the phone and the hardware of the phone itself addictive. Mm-hmm. Now, and this means to me, and you might not agree with that, Sean, other people listening to this might not as well, but for me, therefore, there has to be a kind of collective responsibility for this as well. Yeah. Like, it can't just be a question of individual consumers trying to barricade themselves against the might of a tech giant's persuasive technology program. We also need to bring that under control. We've brought gambling under control. There are ways that, gambling industry can work and ways it can't. And we have to, we identify harm in the gambling industry. And, we in the UK, we have the Gamble Aware, and they spend a certain amount of money, to try and identify problematic gamblers and stop them playing. This is basically a new version of that. Like, this is the next behavioral addiction. It's now in the diagnostic manual. And we just need to, it's another great example actually of hidden power, right?
Yeah.
Of a form of power, which is now really only possible because of tech. No one really knows about it. It shapes billions of people's behaviors every day, and it's entirely outside of any kind of regulatory control right now.
Yeah, which is scary, right? When you're talking about that, and before you even said, there's got to be some sort of collective control and where we all agree, hey, listen, there's some boundaries here that we've all got to follow and figure out, because man, that even as aware as you want to be, and as when you start talking about these classes on that every tech giant's going to learn how to persuade us and influence us and everything else when we're opening these apps and all the dopamine hits and all of our consumer behavior, psychological behaviors, and it's like, man, there's a lot of smart people trying to for lack of a better word, but probably not a better word, manipulate us, right?
No, and yeah, for sure.
That's exactly what they're doing, right?
Yeah, they'll euphemistically call it the itch or something, but right. Yeah, it hook or yeah. Manipulate, yeah. And they are smart. They're really smart. They're highly incentivized. They're incredibly well-resourced, and it, we can see the results. Mm-hmm. We can all see the results. You now need to have a bowl to imprison the smartphones in. Parents up and down the country, sometimes it's quite emotional. They would say they literally do not know how to get the device out of the hands of their kids.
Yeah, I've heard that. It's crazy to me, right? And it's easy. Like Teresa and I were talking about this. So we were having coffee. You probably had your tea, but we had our coffee.
I don't like tea, actually.
You don't like tea? I couldn't find any coffee when I was in London. I was like, I got to get some coffee here. So but we were having our coffee and we were talking, and somebody, a family member of ours was saying, they would be so mad my kids would be so mad if I took their phone away. And I would never do that. It's it's their phone. It's a privacy issue, everything else. And I'm just thinking to myself, wow, they really believe that they can't take the phone away from the kid. Mm-hmm. And which was shocking to me, but it's that's the point we're getting to with this stuff. And like you're saying, we imprison them. Like I imprison my kids' phones in a bowl when they walk in the house. I mean, it's like it's the old liquor cabinet, right? That my dad used to lock the liquor up in. It's like we have to do that with phones now. That's crazy. Like when you really think about it. So it's like it's nuts that we're having those conversations, but at the same time is trying to be aware of it and navigating. And we're all kind of trying to figure this out on our as we go.
Mm-hmm. That's right.
Yeah. So as you, as we wrap up, Carl, and this is, I could literally pick your brain on this and talk about this all day. We didn't even get into the kill list. We didn't even get into some of that crazy stuff on the dark web and what you stumble across there and the good, I do want to mention that. So let's talk if you've got another, you know, I know that I want to be respectful of your time. Are you good for another 5 or 10 minutes?
Oh yeah. No, all good. Yeah. Yeah. Awesome.
Because I think that this is important too, is, you know, I'll have you talk about the kill list and what that was, but I watched your TED talk on it and it was really interesting. A couple of things that stood out to me is, you know, these are pretty normal people, at least from the outside looking in, that were trying to have other people killed. Right. And like, holy crap, these seem to be normal people that would be in our everyday lives. But also the good that you've done on being able to uncover that and the risk that you took to try to expose a lot of that stuff, but also like a lot of arrests, a lot of convictions and, you know, continuing to go on with that stuff. But talk a little bit about how that came about, because it was kind of, it sounded like from the backstory I was listening to, it was a little bit by accident.
Yes. Well, to catch people up, my career took something of a right angled turn at some point around COVID time, where a hacker that I knew called Chris, I mean, I had become interested in cybercrime and getting to know hackers, and I'd gone on a cybercrime raid with the police. And in general, I was, you know, the book had drawn me a little bit into that world. And I got to know Chris actually through that. And one day we go to a pub in the middle of London and he shows me his phone and there is a car blowing up. A man kind of holding a note and then the camera pans, the note with his username, Chris's username on, and then the car engulfs in flames. And what happened is that Chris had began to investigate a, believe it or not, assassination market and a hitman for hire market on the darknet. And he thought it was fake, and the administrator had begun to try and convince him it was real. They'd got into a very, very strange confrontation, Chris the hacker and a guy called Yura, the darknet assassin market administrator. And then finally, Yura tried to scare Chris away with this video. And then very fatefully, in 2020, when me and Chris had been brought together actually to do a podcast that we thought was going to be a retrospective of all of this, just looking back and seeing what happened. This happened several years earlier. Chris breaks into the site. He kind of fatefully finds this vulnerability in the way the site works. He kind of wiggles through. He kind of gains back-end access to the site and then begins to basically secretly exfiltrate all the messages. And this isn't a marketplace in the way that like eBay is. People have to imagine this is basically like an online order form. So you kind of log in and then you kind of take out a hit, you know, and you can upload a picture and you can like send in pattern of life information. And that's not supposed to be public. That's supposed to go directly to the site claims it's being ran by the mafia, basically. Mm-hmm. And the mafia basically says, look, like, you know, we'll take your Bitcoin. We're a neutral third party. And then we'll send out an assassin. And Chris breaks in. To his horror, sees that there are actually quite a lot of orders being placed. And then to his second horror, realizes that quite a lot of these actually look quite serious and seem to have actual payments attached to them. And so he gets hold of me. And we kind of begin this, we form this team, the weirdest, the weirdest secret team you'd ever imagine, of like open source intelligence investigators and Bitcoin tracers and local journalists and Chris the hacker and me the podcaster, you know, and we basically, after failing to convince the police that any of this is real, decide that the only thing that we can actually do that seems to make any kind of moral sense is I need to start warning people on the list that someone is trying to kill him. And so in what you can imagine, Sean, to be some of the weirdest, most anxiety provoking and most awkward conversations of my life, I end up having calls with people eventually where after hearing a kind of that this strange British journalist wants to talk to them, you know, they come onto these calls kind of suspicious sometimes, certainly very curious. And then I basically have to tell them, you know, there's no easy way of saying this, but someone is trying to have you killed.
Yeah, I can imagine like I would guess that a lot of people just wouldn't believe you, right? Were they, and then like, or did most people believe you right at face value? Like, okay, well, tell me more.
They didn't. So there's various phases that I've collapsed in this story of trial and error. Initially, we tried to cold call people because we have that, you know, we have some contact information about them. We build that out. You know, we basically got the information about them that an assassin would have. And that doesn't work very well, I have to say. Yeah. You know, people really don't believe that. I mean, maybe people are more skeptical about scams than I thought, but phoning up someone in France, you know, or Taiwan and saying, hi, you don't know who I am, but I have important information for you, doesn't lead to a second bit of that conversation. They just hang up.
Yeah.
But we then actually went to quite a lot of trouble to build a better way of convincing people. So we actually end up sending local journalists to like physically go and meet them. Mm. Knock on their door, door opens, and this person, you know, and then a local journalist tries to not tell them that much until they're on a call with me because, you know, I'm able to kind of furnish more details about this investigation than the local journalist knows about it. So they try and bring it, and then that's the conversation where I then tell them about all of this and then what happens. And then, you know, and then at that point, yes, people do believe me. I mean, sometimes it is genuinely a bolt from the blue. Like, they've got no idea. Like, they really, like, they are totally shocked and they have no idea who it is. But more often, though, it makes some kind of contextual sense, depending on what's happening. Mm-hmm. And I guess the most, I thought people would totally freak out. And actually, people took it a lot better than I thought they would. People are quite calm, actually, in the moment, you know, which I was surprised by. But the most common, like, kind of first thought, I think, was always, I can't believe they've gone this far. I can't believe it's got that bad. I can't believe that person's descent has reached so low. You know, so it kind of, there was a dispute, there was a divorce, you know, but they don't know that it spiraled to the point of danger that it had. But yeah, normal people on both sides of that equation, normal targets, normal perpetrators.
Crazy. I mean, are you still involved in that side of life at all? Are you still doing any of that? Or has that kind of come?
I might be.
maybe not. This is what we can talk about because it's closed, right?
Lesson number one of investigative journalism, Sean, is don't talk about your active investigations.
Gotcha. Okay. I didn't know. I don't know. I just asked the question, right? Like that.
Yeah. So there have been some things that have been thrown up by killers coming out that we're chasing down.
Yeah. It's crazy. It is a crazy. I can't imagine that you don't have a very, very many boring days at the office, I guess, right?
No, I mean, it was, I knew from the very beginning this was going to be the most important thing I ever worked on. I mean, it's bleeding obvious when, you know, someone's trying to kill someone else and there's something you can do about it.
Yeah.
There was a year when this really, really affected us. I mean, I can laugh about it now, but I mean, I was having recurrent nightmares. I was bursting awake, thinking about the perpetrators. We really did not have any time to set up any kind of structure around us. It didn't feel like journalism what we were doing. Journalists don't like phone targets out of the blue and tell them someone's trying to kill them.
Yeah,
you know, it wasn't vigilantism because we were primarily, our number one priority was trying to get the police to act. You know, we didn't want to replace the police. We didn't want the police to do their jobs.
Yeah.
I don't know what we became. We kind of entered this like strange liminal space somehow.
Yeah, it's crazy. It's and it sounds like it continues to evolve. And like you said, it's pretty hard to unsee the things you've seen or unread the things you've read and say, well, I'm going to go work on something else. Because like you said, it's pretty important when you feel like you've got the ability to help and save, I mean, really save somebody's life. I'm saying, hey, listen, I'm going to step in and let you know this is going on. So let's, be aware of it and let's curb the outcome.
I don't feel like, the investigation was what it was, and I'm proud of what we did, and I'm proud of the arrests that happened, and I do think we made people safer, probably, or some people in the end. So I'm proud of all of that, but I don't feel I've yet kind of made sense of all of this in the kind of bigger lesson. Like, so I'm still kind of thinking about all of that. You know, there's some way in which this darknet site tapped into or revealed a genuinely quite worryingly widespread interest that very normal people can sometimes have to have someone else killed. And what the site seems to do was to kind of make murder safe and anonymous.
Mm-hmm.
And, the people that were like writing the orders, like they're not like your rabid serial killer. They're not interested in the act of killing. They don't want to do the killing. That's the whole reason they're on the website, but they are interested in the idea of like murder as a utility, murder as a problem solving tool.
Yeah. Solving a problem, right?
Solving a problem. Yeah. And I don't think we often see this, I think that kind of criminality, that kind of capacity that human beings have, or some people have, I know for the rest of us, you really can't contemplate the idea of actually having someone else killed. There is an enormity there, which there's a gap to get over, but it revealed something there which very, very rarely does reach the surface. And I'm just thinking about what that means and what I can do with that.
Yeah, it's interesting as the bigger picture of just how all of this is affecting the, and like evolving in our everyday lives of, because even just going to like some, you look at some forums and you'll see some chats and you'll see some, when somebody posts something on Twitter and you see all the comments and you read them and you want to talk about some like piss and vinegar in some of those comments. I mean, we don't talk to each other like that. Right. And yet online, there's this anonymity there. There's this veil of like, kind of nobody's going to know who says this. So I'm just going to like spew out this, sometimes the worst things that you would say about somebody. And I think that, comes down to that. It's like many of these people have no interest in like a murder or whatever else, but they're kind of removing themselves from actually what that actually is and saying, well, it's a means to an end to solve my problem or whatever it is. And it's very interesting. I think that you're probably just scratching the surface on what all this is, because I think it's just a matter of, it's made it so easy for us to be able to, I don't know if get away with is the right word, but be able to like do things that we wouldn't do in our everyday lives. I wouldn't talk to somebody the same way that you read some of those things. I'm an real estate investor. I don't do a whole heck of a lot of crazy stuff. We invest in real estate. We do vacation homes, and some of my ads, you think I'm the spawn of the devil and of himself. And it's like, I have no business being alive, and it's like, well, all we do is buy homes. Right,
that's Twitter or Facebook. To kind of needlessly put a kind of researcher label on it, it's called the online disinhibition effect. Okay. The idea that anonymity, there's also something to do with the way that tech removes the cues that you're talking to another human being. When you can't see someone, you can't hear them, you kind of like lose some of the kind of instinctive reminders that humans have that they're actually talking to another human. That's obviously a very widespread force of the internet, which is why, every internet debate ends up with someone calling someone else Hitler. It's right. Why everyone used to flame each other on Twitter when Twitter was still like a functioning social media place.
Yeah.
And in a way, like, I haven't reflected on this until now, but it could well be that the kind of like the hit orders that we uncovered are like the ultimate online disinhibition effect.
Yeah.
Like when you really, really believe you are totally anonymous and totally secure and no one will ever work out who you are, and you can do all of this at a click of a button, what would you do? You know, and I think that's what that site somehow exposed.
Interesting. Yeah. And it's, I guess that's the question for you to continue to try to answer, right? That's your,
do my best. Yeah. It's a knotty one for sure.
It is. Well, Carl, this has been an awesome conversation. I very, very much enjoyed it. I appreciate you joining us on our podcast. Lots of just such an interesting world. Where can we point people to get more of you, what you're doing, your book, where would, you know, your podcast, like all those different places? Where would, if somebody listens and says, hey, I want to dive deeper into this and I want to hear more from Carl, where should we point them?
Well, my website, I normally collect like most of my writing and like broadcast stuff and podcast stuff on the website. That's just carlmiller.co. But if people want to talk to me, then reach out to me on LinkedIn. Love you it. Know, I'm more than happy to answer people's questions or, you know, hear people's reflections and thoughts. That's what makes this job worthwhile. So please do reach out to me there. And, you know, yeah, I always love hearing from people after these kinds of discussions. But
awesome.
Sean, thank you for having me on. Thanks for reaching outside of the envelope of retail investing and having a digital researcher on. And, you know, yeah, I've really enjoyed the discussion as well. And I hope I can graduate from Experts Corner to Whiskey Wednesdays next time.
It's an open invitation because I'd love to have a more of an in-depth conversation. So what you need to do is just make another trip out to Utah.
Make my way out to Utah. Trip,
and then we'll do a Whiskey Wednesday. You just let me know when and we'll make sure we make it happen.
Perfect.
All right. Well, guys, those of you listening, we know how valuable your time is, and we always appreciate you joining us. I know you guys do because you give us the feedback, but I hope you enjoy these conversations as much as I do. We just try to have good conversations, interesting conversations with amazing people and let you listen in. And I know you guys enjoy that. So as always, we will post how to get a hold of Carl in the show notes. So carlmiller.co, and then on LinkedIn, we'll put both of those in the show notes. So you can easily find him, ask him those questions. And then if you guys have other people that would like to be a part of these conversations, we don't run ads or sponsorships on our show. The only way it grows is organically with you guys sharing it, liking it, reviewing it. So if you have more than 30 seconds, do one of those three things. We very, very much appreciate it. And the final, most important thing I ask you at the end of every episode, pick that one thing you can do today, start building that life you don't want to take a vacation from. Cheers, my friends.
Thanks for joining us on this episode of the Vacation Rental Revolution podcast. Share this with other people you think need to hear about it. And don't forget to subscribe and leave us a review. Hey, Grace, is there a website? Yes! For more amazing content and expert advice, visit Bodyssey.com. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you on the next episode.